2008 came around, and the business world was still in that standpoint of kind of testing out this kind of social responsibility and what did that really mean. Mm-hmm. And so when the financial markets kind of crashed, positions of sustainability were not so sustainable in a lot of organizations. But I got the experience of what it took to bring that to life in a company, right? And to see what needed to happen with that. So I translated that, and when I went off to start my own firm with a business partner, we immediately baked in that at the core of it. And we were a women-owned firm. And we kind of said, well, we want to give back, and how do we bake that in? And I'd been following over the years a model that Patagonia had launched, and it's got to be close to 20 years now, called 1% for the Planet. And what they got was small and medium-sized businesses to make a commitment of 1% of revenue, not profit, of revenue, because you can't doctor that number as much. And what I've watched is probably at this point, I haven't checked the number recently, I know what it was 5 years ago, it's got to be probably around $200 million now that they've moved from the small business community to environmental groups that are working to help save the planet. And I thought, wow, there's a lot of power in that, right? That small 1%, when you have a lot of businesses and it adds up to a lot of money. So here I am running a women-led firm that was doing marketing, a kind of boutique marketing firm. And I thought, well, what if we could do, why can't we do the same thing? So we baked in, and you get the idea from the beginning, 1% of our revenue each year, and each year the firm grew, we wrote a bigger and bigger check, and then we would look for organizations, because we're a women-owned firm, we didn't sign on to something like 1% for the Planet, we looked for how can we give back to women in our community, what can we do? And then the other thing we started realizing in that process was that we had skills. We were a marketing consultancy. And so those business skills have value, too, and are needed over the nonprofit. So not only were we writing checks, but we were looking for those skill-based opportunities where our employees could participate with local groups. And you start seeing the genesis, and I'll now explain kind of the transition to working for women. Mm-hmm. In doing that, I could only grow that firm so far. Mm-hmm. But there was what if we could build the organization that would make it easier for all businesses to give back? Because what I also learned during that process of owning my firm was the fact that it took me away from running my business. Like, I wanted to be community-minded. I wanted to go off and do the right thing. But I would then have to go and find the organization, I would have to build the relationship, I'd have to vet them and understand, is this the right place? And then I always, you know, if we were writing a check, I was always like, did that check go to the right thing? How did it actually help? The skill-based opportunities were fantastic, but how do we navigate that in project management? And working for women was kind of the genesis of, if I had an organization that I could work with that would figure all of that out for me, man, it would be really nice to know that what my return on investment is. And we talk about that as return on impact. Because as a business person, those are resources that are going out of my business, right? I want to know if I'm giving it off to nonprofit world, are those dollars going to the best place that they could be? Are those skills going to the best place along those lines? Because just like I want to know with any other investment I'm making as a business person, I want to know what that return is. Mm-hmm. So that was a lot.
Good. No, it's all smart business. I'm just nodding, and I mean, no, it's great. It's kind of like, you know, pledge 1%, volunteer match, vetting, giving, business. I mean, there's so many great things here that you're doing. So it's trend setting. It's what we need. It's timing. It's everything. So I'm excited to dig more into it. We'll take a really quick break, and we'll be back.
Join us for a fun-filled evening at the Hunterdon County Crime Stoppers annual fundraiser, Thursday, November 16th, 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. at Lone Eagle Brewing, 44 Stangle Road, Flemington. Craft beer tasting, great food, door prizes, live music, and a 50-50 raffle. Tickets are $50 each, and sponsorship advertising opportunities are available. Please visit www.crimestoppershunterdon.com or call 908-437-0126. We'll have a barrel of fun.
Home Instead Senior Care. It's our passionate dedication to creating personal relationships between our clients and our caregivers. Visit our website at www.homeinstead.com/325.
Help make your community safer. Hunterdon County Crime Stoppers is a community-based program aimed at making our community safer by providing an avenue for citizens to anonymously report criminal activity. It provides monetary rewards if the information leads to an arrest and indictment. See something, say something, and get cash for your anonymous tip. Call or text 1-800-321-0010 or go online to www.crimestoppershunterdon.com.
Good morning. This is Nicole Smith. You're listening to Happy to Help on Hunterdon Chamber Radio. Today, we're talking with Beth Bankston. She's the founder and CEO of Working for Women. You can find them at workingforwomen.org. And she gave us a little background about where she came from and what her business background is. And now we're going to launch into what is Working for Women and what do they do?
So, thanks for that. The genesis, you know, kind of going through that genesis of what Working for Women and how we got here and thinking through it and kind of the background and experiences I've had, you know, as you and I were talking about before we got on, that life isn't, and especially I found career isn't always a straight line. So I look at Working for Women as being the genesis of my whole career of different experiences I've had kind of gelling together into forming this organization. And through all that, what we did and what I looked at was, and I said before, like I looked for that organization that could help me as a business owner understand how I could best give back and support and know that I was really having a good return. So that's what Working for Women does. We're the genesis. We are an intermediary essentially between the business world and nonprofits that are working to help women in turn stay in the workforce. And I'll give a little bit more as we go on talking about why we chose women and why we chose particularly in that area. But what we do is we work with the business, we bring the business community in, we understand what their skill sets are as they become part of our community, and at the same time we build relationships with the nonprofit partners, right? Because when we were building the business plan for this, and there was a business plan for this organization that was put in place in the beginning, we spent a lot of time talking to businesses and saying what's working and what's not working for you. In a lot of cases, they said, we're giving back, we're doing stuff, but I don't know if we really had impact. We get taken away from our work. We think we've helped, but it's really hard to find the opportunities, and it's really hard to know. You know, the experience isn't always a great one. And we wanted to make sure that we also talk to the nonprofit world, because I think the other piece that I've seen in this journey is the business world tends to always think that they're helping, and that they're coming in, and that they're bringing volunteers, and there's engagements. And what we heard really clearly from the nonprofit directors was, we love having the business community involved, we love them coming in, but a lot of times we're creating projects, or we're coming up with something to meet their needs, to bring their team in or do something. It doesn't always help us in our mission and what we're trying to do. And I thought, well, this is kind of broken. We have the business world who wants to do more in giving back, and we have the nonprofit world that needs to receive more resources, but it's not necessarily effective in what's going on between those two places. And I thought, what if we could create a world where business gets to focus on what they do well, which is generate capital? And what if we could really build the world where nonprofits could do what they do well, which is they're out there addressing the social issues, right? That's what they do well. But why can't we move the resources from the business world and help those nonprofits? Because those nonprofits are also spending so much time trying to fundraise and come up with all the resources to do the work. Mm-hmm. What if we could make it easier for them to just do the work? And that is the essence of Working for Women, is we work with businesses to aggregate their resources. And when we talk about resources, it's dollars and skills. And then we apply them to nonprofits that are working to help women in turn stay in the workforce, with the goal, and what we're looking for in that is capacity building projects. So we're not just moving resources over dollars or coming up. We're actually sitting with those nonprofit directors and understanding what are the things that are holding them back from growing and from a capacity standpoint. And that can either be from an organizational capacity, as in growing their organization, or it can be from a programming standpoint of, you know, it would be great if we had a workshop on financial literacy, and we don't have that for women. Or we could help negotiation skills, where we can bring in that side of it. Because if we help those organizations grow their capacity, then we reach our end goal, which is helping more women get to economic independence in the U.S.
Right, and that, and it's for, so it's more of a kind of a strategy session, because typically nonprofits, they're struggling to, you know, they're putting Band-Aids on everything, and they're struggling just to stay by, and, you know, with turnover or lack of resources and whatever, so they don't have any time or expertise or wherewithal to do that strategic planning they need that could do more good, right?
Yep.
So there's so many cool things about what you're talking about, and maybe you're aware also of Pledge 1%, you know, which is you give either, a company will give either 1% of either revenue, product, employee time, or there's a fourth one, maybe it's equity maybe, I don't know. And there's a lot of different businesses that do that, where they pledge 1% in some capacity like that. So that's taken on a lot of, you know, that's become more popular. Corporate social responsibility has become more easy for me to say. And then, well, the other thing too is you talk about being effective, because a lot of times too with the kids, where they go, you take a bunch of high school kids and they go on a mission trip to Bolivia or whatever, and then, you know, but they're, you know, they're helping, but, you know, they're spending thousands and thousands of dollars to get the kids there and house them and keep them in their little bubble and then let them run over here and help a little bit. And they're like, you know, if you would have just given us all that money that you spent for your kids to fly down here and house them and keep them safe and whatever, that would have done, you know. So basically, these kids get to put something on their resume, and then the kids that actually you're trying to help are, you know, kind of, again, figuring out how can they help us and how can we make them feel good for being here, and it's just backwards, right?
Well, that's a big shift that's going on in the philanthropy world right now, is really sitting and asking the communities, mm-hmm. what do you need? I think for too long we've been going into communities and with nonprofits, right? And I was at fault of this, even from being on the business side.
It was the model.
For opportunities. The model was, oh, you don't know what you're doing. We'll come in there and we'll we'll help you, right? Instead of actually saying to these communities, what is it that you need, and trusting that they know the best, and then bringing in the resources. And that's the approach that we take with the executive directors that we're working with, is really to sit with them and say, okay, so you're running your organization. You know, what are the things, you know, one of my favorite questions is kind of like, what's keeping you up at night? What is the piece mm-hmm. that's holding mm-hmm. you back right now? And hearing them talk about it. And then I'm like, okay, now we'll go off and find the business partner that can help fulfill that, right? And help you move along that. Or, you know, what is it that's in your strategic plan that you don't have the resources as a staff? Or in a lot of cases, it's the business expertise. You have a lot of people that are very passionate about a subject, but actually having that business expertise and the business training is a lot of what's needed in those cases, a lot more than having someone come and clean a park, right, for a day.
Exactly, yeah. And, well, the funny thing, too, is, like, you know, I've said this before, and you probably heard it before, the only difference between a for-profit business and a nonprofit is the tax status.
Yeah.
Like, basically, everything else is the same. You still got to, you know, right? It's true.
So I'm laughing. Okay. Some of you can't see me. But I'm laughing at that because I knew as soon as I met Nicole today, I was like, oh, we're going to be lifelong friends. The biggest thing that I have learned, and especially because you have the business community and who we're speaking with, is I came out of the for-profit world. I had my MBA. I have all training in business, right, and 20-plus years on the business side. And so I'm going to enter the nonprofit world because Working for Women is a 501c3. We set it up as that status. I probably would have gone as social, more a B Corp. I don't know if you've talked about B Corps, benefit corp status. But because we are moving dollars and resources, I wanted people to have that tax deduction. Mm-hmm. So from a legal standpoint, that's the only reason that we are kind of a 501c3 mm-hmm. is in order to move those resources and get the tax advantage. But I was coming out of the for-profit world running businesses, and I was like, okay, I'm entering this nonprofit world. I don't know what this is. So I got a book that said, here's all the things you need to know about nonprofit management. And I went through it, and I looked at it, and I said, this is everything I do in running my, like, there's no difference. And so the reason I had to laugh when you said that is I spent a lot of time telling people what we have is business out there, and business is the overarching. In some place, we've lost business off of nonprofits, and we think of nonprofits as different. But really, I believe you're running a business or an organization, and either it's a for-profit or it's a not-for-profit, right? It's still an organization. All the things that you need to do in running a healthy nonprofit are the same things you need to do in running a business. There are things that are called different, right? Like sales. There's no sales in the nonprofit world, but there's fundraising. Mm-hmm. It is the same skill sets. It's the same requirements. It's called development over here, right? Mm-hmm. So the only thing that's different is just what organizationally, how they've called it, but functionally, it's the same. The biggest gap, though, that we have noticed in doing this and then working with our nonprofits is what is missing in the nonprofit world is marketing and communications. Mm-hmm. Everything gets lumped underneath development and donor management and fundraising, but they don't have, which is why so many of these nonprofits, when we go in and talk to them, the one place where they really need some help is in telling their story, right? And going out there and building their communications, making sure their website is actually really effective at bringing in donors. But that's the same thing that we do as a business, is you want to make sure your website's effective at bringing in sales, right? So it's the same thinking, just different nomenclature in many ways.
Right, yeah, I had to just learn the terms. Just like with any business, you know, you've got your industry terms, your different, yeah. And so thus the birth of Happy to Help, that,
yes.
You know, a platform for nonprofits to shout from the rooftops and tell people what they do. So I'm having a blast doing that. And part of the thing, like you said, with business skills and not in asking the nonprofits and the communities what they need. So that's the one thing everyone knows that I've been involved with Room to Read for a decade, and they've been around for two decades. And one of the things, the first things they did is said, we're not flying over to Asia and Africa, not flying a bunch of Americans over there to boss people around and tell them what to do, because we don't speak the language. So they, all of the country directors and the leaders and the teachers, they're all native of those communities. So that's one thing I fell in love with Room to Read. And the other thing we talked about is that Room to Read 20 years ago was one of, John Wood was one of the first social entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. And you identify yourself as a social entrepreneur. And so why don't you give us your definition of social entrepreneur and what that entails and why you embrace that?
Yeah, it's an interesting, because we have, it's a growing area of people thinking about, you know, how can their business, and the way I liken is, how can your business be a force for social good? So, you know, we're in a time now where it's not just enough for a business to make a profit. And having come out of business school, right, everybody was trained, that was the purpose of a corporation, right? Like that is what business is supposed to do, maximize shareholder profit.
Chainsaw Al.
Yes. And then, you know, now we're in a time where it's not enough. People are looking and saying, you know, what else, you know, how is your business? I look at it as kind of the evolution of even the price of competition. You know, when I've talked about this in the past of thinking about it, in the beginning, your product just had to function, right? And then we started looking at price competition and function and price. And now it's, well, how is your business trying to help save the world? It's another factor that comes in. But that's a big demand on businesses also, because now how do you become a social entrepreneur? How do you understand where the best place is to put those resources that you can actually really help? Because it's a lot just to run your own business, especially on the smaller side. So you have a lot of businesses that are going out there and starting up, and in true social entrepreneurship is actually identifying a social problem and figuring out how you can bring business in to solve it. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite cases of that is Stonyfield Yogurt, right? Mm-hmm. Like when you look at the core of Stonyfield Yogurt, the reason that business came into being was they wanted to get more people doing organic farming in the U.S. and really start a movement of organic farming. Mm-hmm. They did that through yogurt.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't that they set out to start a yogurt company. That wasn't the point. They set out to solve a social problem, and yogurt is through the way that they started addressing that. To me, that's the true kind of social entrepreneur business. But not everybody can do that. Not every business is going to be built to solve a social problem. But I do believe every business can help participate and give back and make the world a better place as we go forward.
Right. Well, like Chobani rose to, but you know, that was more a refugee who built a business, but then also has tent.org and give, you know, so that, I mean, kind of in the same vein, but not maybe 100%. I don't know.
I'd have to look at it, but it is.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
It started with, you're starting for a larger reason, mm-hmm. and the mechanism just happened to be, you know, how you got in doing that. And, yeah. you know, but then you also have companies like Patagonia, which are very environmentally focused. Mm-hmm. But they didn't start Patagonia to save
right.
the environment. They started Patagonia because climbers had a problem. They wanted to have things. But then they started realizing over time that they were destroying the environment. So how could they, you know, you're kind of killing off the stuff that you love, and what kind of was the premise for the company,
yes,
which is all the gears and climbing stuff. But if you're harming the environment and doing it, then there's not going to be future generations of doing that. So what's that business's responsibility in ensuring mm-hmm. that everything is still preserved for future generations?
Right. And just to shift gears a tiny bit, but what it's hard. So maybe, you know, of course people want to save the planet and they want to do good and they want to be well, but they're managing their job, their family, you know, everything else. So what was the deciding factor for you to say, hey, I'm, you know, this is the way I'm going, I'm starting this, because it's not easy, right? Not easy. So, yeah. You know, what was the deciding factor for you to take that leap of faith and be like, I'm doing this and I'm going for it, and here I am?
You know, I think you just hit a certain point in your career, and it's just time, right? You look at it and you think, how can I use my skills at the highest and best use? And again, you know, remember I was running a firm and I was seeing firsthand, like here it was. And at the same point I was running that, and we were giving back, and I was seeing how it took me away from running the business, and my time was best spent running the business because that's what's going to generate more revenue. But that it was really important to our employees and to the people that were part of our business to have that outlet and have that piece. But I never had enough time to put against it to know if we were really doing the best that we could. So like I said before, that was kind of the genesis of someone needs to be doing this. And I'll be completely honest, I spent the first 2 years trying to find someone else to do it because I didn't think it should be me. At the same point, I was watching 1% for the Planet growing and seeing that, and I thought, well, what if we could do this for women, right? And when you look at, and we're not just built for women, while the name is Working for Women, a lot of the firms that have come in and the businesses that are part of our network are privately held, but they're not only women-run businesses, yeah, right? So I want to dispel that, because we've learned everybody wants to help. And truthfully, if you're investing in women, you're investing in women, the families, and the communities. It is a good investment that gives back and strengthens our communities on multiple levels. But so I'm watching 1% for the Planet grow, and they're moving all this money over to the environment. I thought, well, I'm a women-owned firm. I didn't join 1% for the Planet because I want to help support women. I want to give back and help other people get the chances that I've had. And I thought, well, what if we had a 1% for women? Why can't we do the same type of thing and make that genesis of creating that same, along the lines of the same model? So at some point it was just a leap of faith of saying this needs to exist out there. And it was also looking at the facts. So I think the last American Express report that I saw, probably just ahead of the pandemic, was in the U.S., and remember, we're not just built for women-owned businesses, but I just want to paint a picture. If women-owned businesses all made a commitment of 1% of their revenue, the last figure I saw was $18 trillion
wow.
women-owned businesses wow. are responsible for in terms of revenue across the U.S. So if you could take 1% and build that community to do that, we're talking about $18 billion that you could move from the business. And we're not talking for a business making a huge commitment, really. You know, you can bake the, and this is what we did, was we baked it into our bottom line each year. Like, that was a line item in our budget. So it wasn't kind of like, well, where we are or anything like that. We made it part of how we ran the business.
So
I've always had that in my mind
yep.
after watching what went on the environmental side. I was like, wow, we can just get, and even if we can't get every women-owned business, right? Even if we just got a good percentage of them, we're still talking about a lot of money.
Yeah, no, that's incredible. So I think one of the things that hinders people from donating or engaging, because it is, there's so many out there, and, you know, do you know, and then the whole issue of, like, is it going to overhead? Is it going to programs? And, or is it, you know, is it going to executive salaries? Or, you know, how do you know your dollars are getting to where they need to be and giving them the resources they need? So when you vet your organizations, like Bottomless Closet, which is an amazing video on your website, or how do you go about vetting those nonprofits that you partner with?
So, great question. So, one of the things that we've done in the beginning, because we were, you know, getting up and going, we've been in market, this is our third year in market, was how are we going to do that? We don't have the staff, and to go into an intensive vetting. the first place that we start right now is we talk with a lot of foundations on a regional, because as our program grows out regionally, we'll talk to the women's foundations and the other foundations in the area and ask them what are the most impactful programs that they're seeing for women. And I'll be completely honest, almost all of these programs are small and grassroots. We don't invest in women in this country, and we definitely don't invest in women that are on the poverty line or in margins. So the amount of dollars that are going there are so minuscule. These organizations are very scrappy, and we can make a meaningful impact very quickly with them and help them advance because, again, I'll stress it again, we don't put a lot of dollars there. And I want to give, because it's always shocking to people when you kind of give them a sense in the U.S. of how many dollars do go there. When we started working for women 3 years ago, it was 1.2% of all philanthropy in the United States goes to women and girls.
What? Unbelievable.
1.2%.
Oh, my gosh.
We have just, the latest stat is it's less than 1.6%. So we're climbing in the last 3 years. And the majority of those dollars goes to health and reproductive services for women and girls. Which is fine, but that's not helping families get out of poverty. That's not helping single mothers. That's not helping people gain access to jobs. That's not helping change
You know,
the dynamic. When you think about if it's only 1.6% of all philanthropy going into that, and even less of that going to helping women get to economic independence or mobility, there's no dollars going into these organizations. So we can have a pretty meaningful impact pretty quickly, even just with doing skill-based projects and helping them. And no one's really sitting down with them and saying, hey, what do you need? How can we help you do more? And how can we help you reach more women in your communities?
Right. Now, that's well, what about the whole movement with, well, obviously after the pandemic and women and lives and all that that's going, but also the big movement with the hats and the march, the women's march and all that. Has all that helped? Do you think that's helped? Or
so, I was at the first Women's March, and I thought, this is great, and we're all out there marching, and this is fantastic. And it has had a huge impact in women in government, and I think bringing more women into the political thing. Mm-hmm. But I walked out of there, and remember, I'm a business person. I was like, I want to do something, right? I want to change. And to me, the Women's March is, and those types of things are really important, and activism is really important in terms of raising this. Mm-hmm. But you also have to back it up with having tangible places where you can make change.
Call to action.
Influences and call to action. And to me, working for women is the business community's kind of version of the Women's March, right? Like, here's what the business community can do. Mm-hmm. If it's not enough for you just to go out there and march, here's how you can also help support women, is get involved in a group like ours.
Right. So talk about, you came from corporate social responsibility, which I don't even know how it started. It started like a decade ago, right? The corporate social responsibility.
Maybe more than that. I'd have to go back and date it. I mean, large corporations, Fortune 500, have had probably over 20 years CSR departments.
Oh, really? Well, because, I mean, I know you used to always give to the United Way and the Red Cross. Like, you know, that was all built into a lot of these, or they had foundations.
And they still are.
Yeah, totally. But the whole term CSR. But anyway, so that's been, and you said you were the first VP of Positive Impact. So it got, you know, it kind of got more. And then
got into smaller companies. Smaller companies were doing it. Larger companies were doing it because they were being held accountable. So you have to realize that the CSR, corporate social responsibility place, came out of ESG, and I'm going to throw another acronym.
Oh, environmental, social governance.
Was the first phase of that, and that came out of, I'd have to go look, but probably out of the 70s, and everybody's starting to look at the environment. So this whole movement got started more from an environmental standpoint.
Because Earth Day started in 1971, maybe, or something.
Yeah.
I forget. Yeah, okay.
Because businesses were being held account, especially large businesses, for their environmental footprints.
Oh, okay.
And then people started looking a little bit more at social. So the social piece is a little further behind in a way, but you always had ESG.
I had it flipped, but good to know.
Merged into corporate social responsibility, and that's where companies started setting up bigger groups and having groups that were saying, okay, what can we do from a social? But even in a lot of those larger companies, and I've done work in my past life for a lot of Fortune 500 and did some work in their CSR departments, there's church and state. of, because they're more corporate. So if you have a very large entity like a Johnson & Johnson that sits in its own place on a corporate standpoint, it's not always aligned. It's changing now, but it wasn't always aligned to the brands. The brands were doing what they're doing, and then corporate was doing, thinking about their environmental footprint, their social footprint. Now you see that shift, and you're starting to see it come into more brand marketing and what brands are doing, and the and aligned to the products that you're actually buying. And a lot of that comes from what we were talking about before, because things like Stonyfield yogurt and some of these other products in Patagonia, people saw, oh, people are willing to buy, like they care, they want to put their dollars towards something that's making a difference. So that's why you start seeing it becoming more mainstream in thinking about it.
Well, I mean, that you vote with your consumer dollars. That's the ultimate vote, right? What you're buying, right?
Yep.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. And then, well, and then there was talk that the CSR was still somewhat siloed within HR, right? And then now you're seeing it expand beyond that into, like you said, baked into the bottom line, and then and it goes through the whole supply chain. We're not, you know, we're giving, but we're also looking at, you know, who we work with, where we source our products, where we, you know,
I mean, it's when you have a good CSR or function going on, it's not just what's happening in the company; it's the companies you're working with.
Mm-hmm.
It's the what you're doing for the employees. You're looking at it very holistically and how you mm-hmm. run your business. And now, you know, even with what we're doing with this, I don't want to call it a trend, but this move towards more skill-based volunteering. Mm-hmm. We're talking with a lot more employee engagement groups within these large companies mm-hmm. because the employees don't want to just go off and kind of, you know, clean a park. That's great. But they want to see how they can actually take their skills and, you know, they know they've got HR skills or financial skills, those types of things, and how can they apply those skills outside of their organizations.
Right. Well, and there's another twist to that too. So, you know, maybe you're an accountant by day and you're really good at it and you love it, but maybe you don't want to do accounting at night or for volunteers. And maybe like, well, maybe I'll go out on a limb and do marketing. You know what I mean? Because also to advance in your careers, especially with these millennials or people transitioning or wanting to rise to that next level, with all the different successful CEOs and executives, you've got a dual skill set. So I say, if you want to volunteer, you know, yes, you can stay within your skill set. Like my husband's an accountant and like he loves accounting and he would never like say, never, you know. But if you, so if you want to use your expertise to volunteer skill set, fine. But if you want to branch out as well, though, a nonprofit is a great place to do it. Like it's, I mean, you know, not that you're going to mess it up, but it's a safe kind of like incremental way to kind of test those skills and expand your skills, and it's win-win. That's my take on it.
So what we've seen firsthand in the projects when we bring them in is that, and it was interesting because, you know, we go off and we talk to businesses about, hey, you need to be doing social good. And businesses are like, yeah, we are. It's kind of checked the box. So we went off, we did something. I don't understand why. What I've struggled with in the CSR space my whole career and a lot of CSR professionals do is, what's the business return? Why is this good for my business? People get it intellectually, but business people want to know, like,
what's in it for me?
What's in it for me? And what I've gotten to see, and even as we launched Working for Women and we started doing more skill-based projects, we went in there with, oh, we're completely helping the nonprofit, we're bringing these skills over, we're helping them grow their capacity, that's all wonderful. And you're doing great social good. What I saw firsthand was the business case, though. What we're bringing is learning and development opportunities for employees of organizations to stretch their skills
mm-hmm.
in new industries, if thinking about nonprofits, trying with new types of places where they get to take that skill set. I've seen in one of our large corporate partners, employees getting to get client management skills that they may not have gotten with the clients because they're junior employees, that they get the ability to kind of reach and like what you talked about, a safe environment and someplace where they're feeling good. So I kind of have flipped it and I said, what we're really providing is learning and development opportunities while doing social good. Mm-hmm. And I think that link needs to be made of people understanding that it's a great opportunity, not just for the nonprofit to get the skills, but for your employees to be able to further their skills and advance their skills, which we all know when you bring that back in is good for your business, right? If I've learned how to take my skill set and apply it to a different problem set, that creativity is going to come back to me in the organization to work on the businesses. So it's good for business.
Right, and that's the 21st century skill is creativity, right? You can't, you know, robots not yet can do creativity.
Exactly.
So let's take it one step further. So you said ESG came out of the giant, you know, Fortune 500, then it morphed into CSR, which is great. But now you were seeing with the pandemic and businesses closing and people side hustle and shuffling and repurposing. So you see a lot more entrepreneurial type businesses, women starting their own business, marketing, brand management. So I've been trying to talk to people about, even if you're a solopreneur or a small business or whatever, you can still incorporate a component of giving back that benefits your business and your community. So tell people how to do that.
Wow, you set me up beautifully on that. So that is a big reason of why Working for Women also exists. So even when I was running my other firm, I would go off and talk to people about what we were doing and giving back, and I would hear again and again. So, you know, while we talked about larger firms, really Working for Women's genesis at the beginning was to make it easier for small and medium-sized businesses to give back and make sure that it was a meaningful contribution. Mm-hmm. So I would hear from firms, and they'd be like, well, I'm a sole entrepreneur. I can only write a check for $100. Or is that really going to make a difference? Other firms would be like, well, it's $1,000. Like, is that really going to move the needle? Like, why? So the other piece of our model is the fact that we aggregate those funds. So no matter what size business you are, it's coming into, the dollars are coming into a centralized fund. So that $100 could be part of $100,000, could be part of $500,000. Thinking back to that 1% for the planet, mm-hmm. right? A bunch of small and medium-sized firms all make a commitment. The dollars add up really quickly. And one of my board members pointed out to me recently, let's see if I get the math right, but if we got 1,000 members, right? So just think about 1,000 members, even writing a check of $100 or $1,000, it starts aggregating the power of that collectivity mm-hmm. could have tremendous impact in this area of bringing dollars over. And then what we do is then make sure those dollars are getting applied to projects that are going to grow that capacity, mm-hmm. right? So your $100 will be able to report back to you and be able to say, here's what you helped fund. And your $100 could be part of that $100,000 project that makes this organization go further along. And to me, that is a huge incentive as a business person to want to participate, right? Because that collectivity, we can't do it on our own. Large firms, they have the resources to hire a CSR department. Mm-hmm. Small and medium-sized firms do not have that ability to do that, but they have resources that are really needed.
And they can participate that way, collectively. Yeah, I love that whole model, and I think that's incredible. I think people need to realize that and hear that, and that's exactly what you're doing. So we're going to take another quick break, and then we'll be back.
Help make your community safer. Hunterdon County Crime Stoppers is a community-based program aimed at making our communities safer by providing an avenue for citizens to anonymously report criminal activity. It provides monetary rewards if the information leads to an arrest and indictment. See something, say something, and get cash for your anonymous tip. Call or text 1-800-321-0010 or go online to www.crimestoppershunterdon.com.
For over 50 years, Hunterdon Medical Center has been a leader in delivering comprehensive medical and health services to our community. Our staff is committed to providing the highest quality of care to our patients. If you need a physician, we can refer you to over 300 of the best. Call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Are you in business, not a member of the chamber? Come to the Hunterdon County Chamber Expo to see what it's all about and meet other business owners. Enjoy the restaurant showcase and enter to win the door prize just for business entries. The Chamber offers special benefits for new memberships during the Expo. So join us at Next Level Arena on Case Boulevard in Flemington on Thursday, November 9th from 2 to 7 p.m. Don't miss it.
Good morning. This is Nicole Smith. You're listening to Happy to Help on Hunterdon Chamber Radio at Happy Hunterdon. Before we get talking with Beth again, I do have to do a quick plug for our Women's Leadership Summit. It's this Friday morning from 8 to 11, I think. We're having a little bit of networking, and then we're speaking with Megan McDowell, who is the founder of HeartWorks, NewJersey.org, And then we're also speaking with our other keynote is Nicole Piazza, who started the Clean Plate Kitchen in Clinton. And the subject is going to be resilience. And these two women are amazing speakers and business owners. And we're, again, you get the opportunity to network, and you can register for this event. It's going to be a virtual event on Zoom, and you can register on the 100 Chamber website, 100chamber.org. So sign up for that and join us. It'll be a fun morning, Friday morning. All right, now we're going to go back to business with Beth Bankston, who is the founder and CEO of workingforwomen.org. And really can't have any conversations today with talking about how the pandemic has affected our lives and where we go from here. So why don't you take us away with that?
Great. So it was interesting. A lot of people talk, you know, I mentioned before coming out, you know, having that great job of the VP of Positive Impact in 2007 and then heading into what I now understand was the Great Recession. I hadn't, until we went into this pandemic, I never realized it was a Great Recession. And watching the sustainability field, like the CSR field, all get really challenged. And people really question it because everybody was looking completely at one bottom line. While we were professing at that time triple bottom line and talking about people, planet, and profit, when that recession happened, businesses really scaled back and started looking just at one bottom line. So everybody has said to me, well, what's the big shift? Like, we went into a pandemic last year, and I'll admit, here I am starting an organization called Working for Women that is trying to get businesses to give back to the community. And there was a little bit of a panic of saying, oh, is the business community going to do this again? Like, is this what's going to happen? Are we going to go back to retracting and just focusing on profit? But people have to understand that there's a huge shift happening in the business world right now. Mm-hmm. And we talked about it kind of lightly before about how, you know, it's kind of the cost of differentiation in different places. But the August before the pandemic, the business roundtable reissued the purpose of the corporation for the first time since Milton Friedman. And Milton Friedman is where we came out with the thinking of the purpose of a corporation is about maximizing shareholder profit. And those of us that have all gone through business school have all been indoctrinated with that. And so 181 CEOs signed the new purpose of corporation, which states that the purpose of a corporation is to maximize stakeholders. And stakeholders are defined as employees, communities, the environment. Shareholders is last in that group. And broadened it out because it's not good business if you're hurting the environment. It's not good business if you're hurting your community, even if you're maximizing profit. And that thinking is now shifting in the business world.
Right.
Do businesses know how to operate that way? Not completely yet, right? This is a huge fundamental shift in business thinking. And you think we have 50 years of indoctrinating business leaders that there's only one bottom line that they're supposed to be looking at. And now we're asking the business community to do it differently. That's going to take some time. Because some people have said, oh, it's just words on paper. You're right. It is words on paper in the starting place, but it is all of us in our dollars and where we're spending our dollars in moving this movement and strengthening this. The fact that you have 181 business leaders who signed off on it and said our intention is to move our businesses that way means that we have to help support the business community in making this shift. And that's why even organizations like ours couldn't have even been around before, but are needed in helping the business world be able to do that. And we were talking before, you know, I get a lot of questions from small businesses about when's the best time to do it in my life cycle. Like, should I wait? Maybe it's when I met 5 years. Maybe it's when, and I say you bake it in from the beginning because you grow. If you take a mindset of the 1%, there's no reason that even when you're just launching your entrepreneurial business that it can't be in there, because that will grow with you over time. The key thing is making a commitment and saying this is part of how I'm going to run my business. There is no right time to turn this on or do it. It is the right time to do it now, and because it's the right thing to do for your business. It will help and strengthen your business. I've not seen any downside to bringing this type of thinking into a business environment.
Right, and it's so funny how you keep saying bake it into the business, so I just get this image of like June Cleaver in the 50s, you know, how far we've come, like, you know, and and Free to Choose, Milton Friedman, and then also was Larry Fink from BlackRock, was he one of those that instigated that?
A couple years ago, well, the investment community took a, and now the it's becoming more mainstream, like, and that's been around for 20 years. Like, the progress in this has been very slow, of really thinking about investments from an environmental and social governance standpoint. And now you've got more and more mainstream investment advisors really factoring that in to how they're evaluating companies. Where again, that shift of what I talked about, even the signing off, means we have to change how we evaluate what success looks like for the company. Mm-hmm. And as long as we're only looking at a financial bottom line, mm-hmm. then we're not factoring in the true impact that business has in their community. It has to be a broader measure. And that's why you see so much of this conversation around ESG, the environmental, social, and governance, because that's the first place that investment communities are now trying to understand and factor in beyond just how are you, you know, what are the dollars and the profits that you have.
Right, and I think you've also had the impact from the workforce. Like, millennials get all these, you know, raps, but the millennials are they're voting with their dollars, but they're also voting with where they choose to work, because a lot of them won't go to work for a company unless there is that component.
Unless it aligns with their values.
Yeah. Yeah,
but I've even seen, you know, and we started this with the premise that it was more that it's growing in the millennials, but I see it with people later in their career. They're searching for that deeper sense of how can I help, how can I participate, and why do we have to wait until we retire to do it? Why can't it be part of our daily life? And why is it that it's something that we have to do outside of work? Why can't it be incorporated into our work?
Right. I mean, but that again has been just a social shift, a work shift, a you know, whatever, a thought shift, right? So all that has played into
it's
this.
It's going to take time.
It's going to take
time to really see this come to light.
Yeah.
What's amazing is we came out of this, well, we're not out of the pandemic, but working for women got stronger through this time, right? Where the last time when we had a financial retraction, this whole movement went backwards.
Right.
I've seen this movement escalate because people were at home.
Right.
Our virtual skill-based volunteering went astronomical because people also were at home and they couldn't do anything. The best thing that we could do to help was stay at home. People want to do more. They want to feel that they're helping in these times. And so the more that we can activate that and help support that is not a bad thing.
Right. Necessity is the mother invention, right? We learned that with everything going blasting virtual, right?
Exactly.
So it's going to be interesting to see how everything changes. Like, I think there's pros and cons. Like, yeah, it's so easy to just jump on a Zoom instead of having to drive in your car. You know, it just depends. And then the one thing we were talking about was there was some nonprofit conferences recently, and it's nice that you can jump on, you know, in and out throughout the day, but then it's nice when you're at a hotel with a bunch of people for a similar cause and you're totally engaged with, you know, so I think, you know, the flexibility is nice, which is
great. Yeah, it is nice, but there is, I was someone who's been, and I actually have to do a virtual conference tomorrow that I'm speaking at. I've found, you know, while it's nice to not travel, you hit on a really key point with the kind of the conferences. Anything that I've signed up that's a conference at home, it's hard to really set my attention to, where when I used to travel and go to a bit, like, you blocked your schedule, you didn't do anything else, and you were present. Sometimes it's hard to find that place to be present. So that's why I appreciated getting to come here today.
I know. Well, and that's what I love. I love the dynamic that way and stuff. And then, well, the other thing, too, is that the other nice factor about being virtual is that a lot of people have more access to people that they wouldn't have access to go see someone speak or hear or whatever. So, you know, the access to many has been really good, too. So I think there's a lot of benefits that have come out of this. So we were talking, there's a lot of great resources on your website. I saw the MTV promo for International Women's Day. That was amazing. And then tell us about Women Crush Wednesday and what that's
so
about.
So we started, you know, in looking at content and thinking through, you know, different places we could have an impact. And, you know, you look at the news headlines every day, and it's a lot like you having this radio program. We thought, well, we're built to help underserved women in the U.S. and do more. What if we were able to tell the stories more of the women that are working out there on a daily basis? Because like I talked about before, when we talk about how little the funding is, well, think about how little visibility there is to these groups and people that are really working tirelessly to make life better for a lot of people in this country. So that was where our Women Crush Wednesday has really gone and focused. And so we work with foundations across the U.S. to nominate. There's a place on our website that you can go, and if you know a woman in your community that's doing fantastic work for women and families, you know, let us know. And then, because these are the stories that aren't being told. These are the people that are doing it on a day-to-day, a lot like when this conversation around essential workers that we just don't think a lot about. Mm-hmm. And so we want to highlight that. You know, there's a lot, there's plenty out there with celebrities. We want to make these women kind of celebrities along those lines. So, and like you doing your radio, you feel good, right? Like, to be able to tell the story of someone working and in their community and making a difference is such a great opportunity to highlight on a weekly basis. It's nice to be able to put some good energy out in the world to balance so many of the other stories that we hear.
Yeah, and I mean, everyone's got a story. Does it matter? You know, and I just have so much fun doing this. So I feel blessed. I truly do. Well, and that's the great irony of philanthropy, because anyone who does work for anyone, any place, any organization, the one giving the service benefits exponentially more than the person you're helping. So that's funny. It's like, you know, if you can find it in your heart, in your time, in your schedule to give just a couple hours a month, virtually, whatever, to something, somebody dear to your heart or an organization. I mean, you can't even measure the amount it brings to your life.
Yep.
And it's just taking that first step. Yeah, I'm busy. I'm da da da. But you know, it's taking, again, like anything worth doing, you gotta make the change. Right.
100%.
So, we've got a few more minutes, so people can find you workingforwomen.org, right?
Yeah. You're on. Reach out. We're on all the social platforms. not TikTok yet. We haven't gone over there.
I know, right? I know. I've stayed off that because my kids will kill me if I get on it, right? You know, so I'm like, all right. Well, because even Instagram has Reels, and they were mad. Like, no, Reels is just TikTok on Instagram, and they stole it. And I mean, you know, whatever. Yeah. It's a crazy, crazy world out there. Women, workingforwomen.org. And, you know, you can, like I do, I stalk people on LinkedIn, Beth Bankston on LinkedIn.
You can stalk us on LinkedIn. We have a page on LinkedIn. You know, we're fairly active in all of it. Send us, you know, again, like I said, a call to action. Send us a woman that you know is doing great work that people don't know about, kind of like you running this show.
Yep.
We're happy to highlight that, you know, use our nomination form, and we have people from all over the U.S. We ask that it's in the U.S. in terms of focus of work. I think what people don't realize, we spent so much time for so long talking about the need globally, and there's a lot of need in the United States in our own communities for women and families.
You know,
the single quickest way to poverty in the United States is to be a single mom.
Yeah.
And so the more that we can do to focus that and get them is better. It's better for all of us. It's better for business. The more we have everybody rise means there's more money in our economy and more people to purchase and more people to participate.
Right. Well, the ALICE breakfast is coming up. ALICE is the United Way for Women, Asset Limited Income, something. Yeah. So that's a good, that breakfast is coming up next month. That's a great one, ALICE. But I also want to highlight tomorrow's Earth Day. So ESG, figure out a way to help or do. And then this is National Volunteer Month, April's National, and this is National Volunteer Week.
Wow.
So basically, there's no excuse not to do something.
Even if you just pick up trash tomorrow.
Exactly. Yeah, just do, you know, or call an elderly person that's stuck at home. And you know, I mean, that's the goal of the show is to just tell people there's a gazillion ways to help. And sometimes it's overwhelming, but we're here to help you. We're happy to help. Give you an opportunity to help. So
great.
Thank you, Beth.
Thank you.
USA Radio News with Lance Pry.
Derek Chauvin, found guilty of murder and manslaughter Tuesday, will be sentenced in 8 weeks. He will remain in jail awaiting sentencing. 22 coronavirus patients in India who are on ventilators have died after an oxygen tanker leaked at their hospital. Numerous reports are saying 22 people have died due to the interrupted supply of oxygen on Wednesday at the Zakir Hussain Hospital in the city of Nashik. Nashik is about 80 miles northeast of Mumbai. Russian President Vladimir Putin warned against provoking his country in his annual State of the Union speech Wednesday, promising a swift retaliation against anyone who crossed Russia's red lines. Putin said Moscow will respond harshly, quickly, and asymmetrically to foreign provocations. Russia has been building up its military along the Ukrainian border for several weeks. We are USA Radio News.
Newsmax, you like Newsmax. I like it too.
Trump is right. Millions are tuning into Newsmax TV and going to Newsmax.com for real news. Some polls give Joe Biden a high job approval, even 60%. Now Newsmax is asking if you agree with that. Do you really approve of Joe Biden, his policies, and $4 trillion in spending? And do you think President Trump did a better job? Let us know. Vote in the Newsmax poll right now. Just text the word NORTH to 39747. That's NORTH to 39747. It takes just a minute. Let America know who you like better, Biden or Trump. Tens of millions are watching Newsmax TV, now on all major cable systems, smart TVs, and OTT platforms. And vote now in the Newsmax poll. Just text the word NORTH to 39747. That's NORTH to 39747. Let your voice be heard and watch Newsmax today.
A police officer in Columbus, Ohio, has shot dead a 16-year-old girl while responding to an emergency call over an attempted stabbing on Tuesday. The teenager is identified as Makia Bryant. Columbus police have released body cam footage, which appears to show the girl attacking others with a knife before being shot. An inquiry is underway, with officials urging local residents to remain calm. The officer involved, who has not been named, has been placed on administrative leave. The markets are showing some signs of exhaustion. Most major parts of the market have run up significantly in the past month, but there is a growing concern that we are at peak everything. That is, peak earnings growth, peak economic data, and peak reopening. It should be noted that the Standard & Poor's 500 is up 76% from a year ago, but we've had bear markets before, but we've never had this type of rally in such a short period of time. The cooling of the speculative market and a sudden change in interest rates has proven to be an uphill battle for the speculative corner of the market. We are USA Radio News.
Now you can fly anywhere in the world and pay discount prices on your airline tickets. Book a flight today to London, Paris, Madrid, or anywhere else you want to go. And pay a lot less, guaranteed. Call the International Travel Department right now at Low Cost Airlines.
800-215-5141. 800-215-5141. That's 800-215-5141.
As Washington struggles to put together an infrastructure package to help America's ailing inner workings, GOP leaders are putting together a plan of their own. Dan Araki from the Ohio USA Radio News Bureau has more.
Republicans may soon have a counterproposal to President Biden's infrastructure plan. West Virginia Senator Shelley Moore Caputo said Tuesday that she hopes their plan will be ready by the end of the week. The announcement coming a day after a group of bipartisan lawmakers met with the president at the White House to discuss the bill. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said Tuesday that he thinks a more targeted infrastructure proposal would have a better chance at bipartisan support.
Senator Caputo and others in our conference are continuing to work on an infrastructure bill that we think is about what is traditionally considered infrastructure: roads, bridges, ports, broadband, and in the hope that we can convince the majority in the House and Senate to focus on this issue in a way that is more modest than this multi-trillion-dollar bill.
President Biden's proposal carries a price tag of roughly $3 trillion. The Republican plan would cost roughly a third of that. Representative Maxine Waters, the Democrat from California, thanked her Democrat colleagues Tuesday after they successfully tabled a motion by Republican lawmakers to censure her over inflammatory remarks she made about the Derek Chauvin trial over the weekend. For USA Radio News, I'm Lance Pryor.